This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, everybody. This is Minnie, and I am really excited to be sitting here today with Professor Elaine Sadler, who is a professor of astrophysics in the School of Physics at the University of Sydney in Australia, and she's also the director of CASTRO. Can you say hi for our listeners, please, Elaine?
Hi, everybody.
Elaine, what is CASTRO exactly?
So CASTRO is the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for All Sky Astrophysics. So one of the things that happens in Australia is that centres are funded to do research that brings together groups of people across the country in a particular area. And all sky astrophysics means that we're looking at problems that you need to look at very large parts of the sky to solve. So we're funded for 7 years. We do research. We have about 180 researchers across Australia and across the world working on a whole set of different fundamental problems in astrophysics. But within the centre, we also organise a lot of meetings. We do outreach and public education, and we have a very active committee in diversity and gender equity, so trying to encourage more women into science.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's an issue very close to my own heart. And so Elaine is actually going to be giving us here at JBCA the seminar this afternoon. And Elaine's going to be talking about neutral hydrogen in the distant universe, first results from the Australian SKA Pathfinder telescope. So this is very exciting. I've heard that ASCAP has had a lot of recent exciting results. Could you be able to tell us a little bit about what you intend to talk about today and any new ASCAP updates?
Okay, should I start by talking about the telescope? But I'm sure everybody knows about the Square Kilometre Array, the SKA. So one of the things that groups around the world are doing are building smaller test telescopes, really to learn about the sorts of things we're going to do with the Square Kilometre Array, the SKA, and to get experience handling what are really already very, very large amounts of data that are going to come out.
Can you give us an example of how large are these data sets that ASCAP and the SKA are going to produce?
Well, what we've been working with so far is just the first 6 dishes of ASCAP. So ASCAP is a wide field telescope. It's got a 30 square degree field of view.
Wow.
Which means that it takes a lot of data. It sees a lot of the sky at the same time. So what we're using is just 6 dishes to make a little test array. The work we've done was on this array, which was really supposed to be for engineering tests, really to get things calibrated and working. But we managed to get quite a bit of time to do actual astronomical observations. So even with these data sets that are quite small compared to what the full telescope will produce, we're already using a big supercomputer in Perth to get our data processed and get our results out. Again, it takes a few hours for the supercomputer to chew through the data and give us our answers.
So it takes longer to process the data than it does to observe it?
Probably about the same amount of time.
Wow. And in the future with the SKA, will the computers be able to keep up with these ridiculously large data sets?
So the idea is that the computers will get more and more powerful over time. And there's a relationship called Moore's Law that tells you that technology gets better and better. So every year there's a better kind of phone that comes out that can do even more things than last year's phone. And the idea is the same thing will apply to these supercomputers. So that by the time the SKA is built, there'll be computers that are powerful enough to handle all the data, but we certainly don't have those computers yet.
That's very exciting. It's interesting that we're relying on kind of this Moore's Law to process the future data.
And also the computers have to get cheaper and cheaper as well as being more and more powerful so that we can afford to have them.
Of course. So you managed to get some science time on this predominantly or initial engineering array. Did you want to tell us a bit about the science that the ASCAP has been doing?
Yes, there are a couple of reasons why this is a really powerful telescope for what we want to do. So what we want to do is to look at neutral hydrogen in the distant universe, something people haven't been able to do before. The main reason that people haven't been able to do it is that there is a 21 centimeter spectral line, which is the only signature we have of this hydrogen gas. So hydrogen is, of course, the raw material that stars form out of. So if we want to understand how galaxies are going to change over time, we need to understand this reservoir of hydrogen that's the fuel for star formation. We want to know how that changes as we look back into the cosmic past. And what we know is that if we look back 7 or 8 billion years, we see that the rate at which stars were forming in galaxies was maybe 10 or 20 times higher than it is today. So it was a much more vigorous and exciting time in the universe. And we think the reason is that there was probably more gas around that stars could form from, but we actually don't have any evidence of that because we don't know anything about the gas that's in these distant galaxies. In the cold form, that new stars like to form from. So this is what we want to find out. And to do this, we have to observe the redshifted line down at lower frequencies. And that takes us to a range of radio frequencies where there are a lot of transmissions from here on Earth. So there are motor car ignitions, there are mobile phones, there are TV stations, radio stations, aeroplanes, everything you name it, which means that most radio telescopes in the world don't even try to observe at these frequencies.
So the 21 centimeter line at redshift zero or on Earth would emit at 21 centimeters.
Yeah. And that's a protected band so that radio telescopes have a clear view. And so for nearby galaxies, there's no problem. We can observe them in lots of detail.
But for distant galaxies, this line is redshifted, which means the wave, the wavelength is longer.
Yes, and so it's not in this protected band anymore. It's competing with all the other radio noise that comes from our own environment here on Earth. And so people have not been able to see the signal. But the wonderful thing about ASCAP, which is on the SK site in Australia, is that it's essentially free of terrestrial radio noise in the band that we want to look at. So it's completely clean, and it means we've got a clear view into a part of the universe that people really haven't been able to see for about 30 or 40 years.
Can you remind me what the density of people is at the ASCAP site?
So the ASCAP site is in a council area called Murchison Shire. And Murchison Shire is about the same land area as the Netherlands. And the population is around 100 people that live in that shire. Very quiet. They don't have television or radio stations there. So it's really perfect for what we want to do. It's, of course, a very remote area. And that brings its own problems. We're off the grid, so we have to generate our own electricity.
Renewable?
There is renewable, so there's a solar power plant going in and lots of sunshine there, so it's a perfect place to do that. And also we need a big, powerful fibre link to take all the data from that remote area down to Perth where the supercomputer is.
So ASCAP is excellent because it's in this very remote area where the sky at those lower frequencies are free from RFI and you can study neutral hydrogen in the distant universe. It's 8 billion light years away from us.
So we're looking at what we call look-back time. So the light takes time to reach us. So we're looking back somewhere between about 5 and 8 billion years into the past of the universe. A time when there was much more vigorous star formation. The evidence is actually that there wasn't a lot more hydrogen in galaxies, so that's a bit puzzling. But we actually don't know whether we have a complete census of what's going on. The observations are very patchy and we don't have a very clear picture of where this gas might be, what sort of galaxies it might be in.
So there's no evidence that there's more hydrogen, but you've got much more star formation occurring. Could it be that, you know, back then the universe was more dense or...?
There's a couple of places you could put this. It needs to be fairly cold gas to form into stars. So it could be atomic hydrogen, which is what we see in the 21 centimeter line. Or it could be molecular hydrogen, where the two atoms of hydrogen combine to make a molecule that's colder. That's even harder to see. But you can sometimes see it through other molecules like carbon monoxide through millimeter telescopes. And so there's some indication that maybe quite a lot of the gas is in that molecular phase. But even so, it's going to be mixed in with the atomic phase that we see at 21 centimeters. So I think what we'll find out is where this gas is, what sort of galaxies it's in. Is it in galaxies that are very dusty that we don't see with optical telescopes and we haven't looked at before? Or is it in ordinary galaxies just like the ones we see around us?
That's very cool. So it says in the abstract for your colloquium that you guys have results from already 100 bright radio sources. That's a lot of data. Is this something you can do because of the wide field of view?
No, we're actually, at the moment, because we've only got 6 of the dishes hooked up, we have to look at quite bright sources. We've been looking at one at a time. When the full telescope's done, then we'll have this much bigger field of view. We have to look at about 100 sources at a time. One of my colleagues, James Allison, has written a really nifty automatic line finder, so he can automatically find these little blips that come from hydrogen gas so that we don't have to have humans look at them. The computer will actually just grind through the data and tell us where it thinks the little bits of gas are in the distant galaxies.
So why are you focusing on absorption features as opposed to emission features?
So the emission features, as the galaxy gets further and further away, the signal gets fainter and fainter, and it gets fainter as the distance squared. So if the galaxy is twice as far away, the signal's 4 times fainter from emission, and it becomes harder and harder to pick up. If the galaxy is 10 times further away, then you either need a telescope that's 100 times bigger, or you need to observe for 10,000 times as long, and either of those are quite difficult. So people haven't been able to observe this 21-centimeter line in emission much beyond relatively nearby universe. The nice thing about the absorption is what you see is you've got a very bright radio source somewhere in the background, and what you'll see is as the light from that radio source comes, if it passes through a gas cloud, you see this little blip at one frequency, and that frequency tells you the distance of the gas cloud. And if there's a couple of little blips, it can tell you about what the gas is actually doing, whether it's rotating, whether it's coming in or out of that galaxy. So that's how we find them. And the beautiful thing about the absorption measurement is that the detectability doesn't depend with distance. It only depends on having a bright enough source in the background. So the whole universe is open to us with this technique, so long as we've got telescopes and receivers that can pick up the right frequency.
The results from these 100 bright radio sources, this is what you said, there's no evidence for an excess of hydrogen or more hydrogen at these.
It's really too early to tell. So what we were doing here is we're testing out the sort of techniques that we want to use when we have the full telescope. So we're saying, is the telescope stable enough to measure these signals that we want to measure? Are we seeing them coming in at the rate that we expect that they would? Are we finding them reliably? And so on. And what sorts of galaxies are they in? So when we find one of these 21-centimeter lines, we want to know, is it in a big galaxy, a small galaxy? Is it a galaxy with an accreting black hole? Or is it just a small galaxy that's along the line of sight to something much further away?
And so what are the implications if there really isn't as much hydrogen as one would expect given the increased star formation rate? What does this imply?
It implies that the gas is probably hidden in some other phase that we can't see. If you have a very hot ionized medium, that can be quite hard to detect if it's diffuse gas. We know that gas has to cool and form stars, so maybe it could do that very quickly. But generally, if we don't find this gas either in the atomic phase with 21 centimeter line or in the molecular phase with a millimeter telescope like ALMA, then there's something we really don't understand about how these galaxies are different from the galaxies around us today.
That's really cool. I'm really looking forward to your colloquium later today. So ASCAP presumably doesn't just look at hydrogen absorption. What else is ASCAP looking at?
It can look at what we call radio continuum sources. So it looks at like a broadband picture of the radio emission from many, many, many different galaxies. That can come from galaxies like our Milky Way, where you've got supernova remnants and other things, exploding stars that make radio hiss, sort of radio static. Or you can get radio emission from jets that come out of supermassive black holes in distant galaxies. Again, the power of the telescope is really these very wide field images that it can make. So it allows you to find really rare and interesting objects if you know what it is that you're looking for. A lot of studies of polarization that can tell you something about how magnetic fields built up in the universe over cosmic time. There'll be some very nice studies of our own Milky Way galaxy, trying to work out how all the bits of the Milky Way are put together. And also a lot of really interesting work on transient radio sources, variable sources, things that change very rapidly, usually because there's some sort of extreme physics involved. So exploding stars, gravitational wave signals, pulsars, all sorts of different things.
So the wide field of views
is good for a number of things. It's good if you want a large sample, because if you're thinking about something that's evolving, it might be evolving very slowly. And if you've got a big sample, then you've got all the different ages and stages of the evolution there. On the other hand, if you've got a rare object, something that only happens just very occasionally, then if you've got a big area of sky, something like the fast radio bursts that are very powerful, we don't really know what they are, you're much more likely to be able to find one of those if you're looking at a big area of sky. You're not likely to see it if you're only looking at a small bit.
Wow, ASCAP sounds really exciting. I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit about some of the other projects that you're involved with. I know that when I was in Australia, you were working on the AT20G survey, which I thought was very exciting and a very innovative use of the Australia Telescope Compact Array.
So one of the things I like to do, again, AT20G was also a wide area survey covering the whole sky, but instead of having a big field of view, that was done with a telescope that actually scanned across the sky very quickly. So it was like dashing across the sky rapidly and building up a picture in strips of what the whole sky looked like. It took us 5 years to do that survey, observing for about 1 month every year and just building up this image of the sky. But if we look at the 21 centimeter line, we know a redshift and we know a distance. If we just look and we see some radio emission coming, but it doesn't have a spectral line, we don't know how far away it is. It could be something very luminous at a large distance. It could be much less luminous and nearby. So the way that we learn more about these kind of radio sources is that we have to match them up with some sort of optical galaxy that we can study, and we can find out what's going on there. So what I've been doing for the last few years is taking that 20 gigahertz survey and saying how many of those radio sources can we associate with really nearby galaxies that we already understand well.
And do any of these AT20G sources have H1 detection?
Yes, they do. And in fact, we're using these local sources as part of our tests for our H1 studies. So these sources tend to be quite compact, so they've got nice high contrast. They are in galaxies that generally there's a rapidly accreting black hole, so you know there's probably some gas there. And they're very good places to find galaxies in which gas is actually falling onto a central black hole. And what you can do with the H1 absorption, when you know that the gas is inside one of these, what we call active galaxies, then you can use that to try and work out what's going on with this gas. Is it falling onto the black hole? And what often happens is not that the gas is falling in, but there's a radio jet that's actually driving gas clouds out of the galaxy. And so galaxies exchange gas with their surroundings. You think of it as an island universe, that it's just this little ecosystem. But in fact, a galaxy can be quite a violent place, and it can expel quite a lot of its gas out of the galaxy, take it away, so that it can't form new stars. And in fact, some of the mystery gas we were talking about before could actually be in places way outside of galaxies rather than in the places that people have been looking, which is in the galaxies themselves.
So this is the feedback that people talk about a lot.
This is what we call radio mode feedback, yes.
And I think that's really fascinating because the black hole, the central AGN, is very powerful, but it's very small in the scheme of things, and yet it seems like the black hole is very closely linked to the galaxy itself and the star formation.
So it's particularly interesting when you get these radio jets that come out of the black hole. You've got plasma here that's been ejected at almost close to the speed of light. Now, the luminosity of those, compared to things like the stars in the galaxy, is quite small, so people thought for a long time it wasn't very important in the life of a galaxy. It was kind of an exotic thing. But what people have realized is that this stuff that's coming out is going very fast, and it has a lot of momentum. So I always think this is a bit like a dimly lit express train. So if you're standing on the tracks and an express train comes with its lights off, you can't really see it, so you think, well, there's nothing much there. But of course, if it hits you, then there's quite a profound effect. So that's pretty much what the radio jet is. It's punching through the galaxy, and even though you don't see very much, it has a profound effect. And the gas can actually get caught up in this jet and taken away to large distances. It takes a long time to come back again, if it ever does.
That's very cool. We've had, I think, a few speakers talking about feedback, and this is an area I find very interesting. Well, we're very lucky to have you. Thank you so much for making the time to let us interview you for the Judcast.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Minnie. It's very good to talk to you.
Thank you.